Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. And today is April 7th. We are going to start today, as usual, with a roll call. And we have a lot of business to get to today. So, Ms. Niedernhofer, please take the roll.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt. Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Eklund.
Eklund, present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Bonner.
Present.
Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Dameth.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grunhagen.
Present.
Keel. Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Munson.
Munson, present.
Pryor.
Pryor, present.
Kwong.
Present.
Ryer.
Ryer, present.
Schultz. Wolgamott. A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. And just to say that some members are probably still making their way back from the House floor, so I'm sure they will be joining us shortly. And we'll note their presence when they come in. So next order of business is to approve the minutes of April 1st. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move the minutes for April 1st, 2022.
All right, thank you very much. And members, these were sent out with your packet. And is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes of April 1st, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Thank you. So the big order of business today is to walk through the DE amendment to House File 4706. This is our health finance bill, the same bill that we heard. We went through the spreadsheet in our joint hearing with the Human Services Committee, but now this focuses only on the health parts of the bill. And let's see, I think Mr. McQuillan, should I move the DE? Well, I need to move the bill to get it before the committee, I assume. And so is that correct? And then I should move the DE amendment so that we can have this before us. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's your call, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right, I think we should do that then. So I'm going to move House File 4706 just to get that before the committee. And then the DE amendment, which is our actual health finance bill. And I don't have the, I don't think I have the actual coding for that, Mr. McQuillan, if that is the DE1 or what the code is on the amendment, just for clarity. Or maybe one of the House staff knows. Ms. Hunderman?
Madam Chair, it's the A22-0419.
Okay, so that number that she just said is what I am moving to get it before the committee. So with that, I think I'm turning first to Mr. Chun, and just to remind everyone that these folks are going to be walking through the bill. They are are the stars of our show here, and they have been doing tons of work. And I think what we'll do is kind of what we did in Human Services. If members could, as we do the walkthrough, which is, you know, the bill is long, as we do each article, maybe we could just pause and see if members have technical questions. And if you do, we'll call on you to ask those, but we have a lot to get through and we have a lot of public testimony as well. So if members could just keep it to technical questions, and we will keep our comments and our debate for tomorrow when we do markup, if that's okay with everyone. Representative Schumacher, does that sound like a reasonable plan? Okay, he didn't know I was gonna ask him, so.
Yeah, sounds good, Madam Chair, thank you.
All right, thank you, Representative Schumacher. Okay, so with that, I think we're gonna go first to Mr. Chun. No?
Madam Chair, Ms. Sunderman will start off with Article 1.
All right, thank you very much, Ms. Sunderman. And I'm gonna go and grab my hard copy of the bill so that I can follow along. And please begin.
Hello, Madam Chair and members. I'll be starting the walkthrough with Article 1, which is the Department of Health Finance article. Sections 1 through 6 are from House File 4398 as amended, which is the governor's bill. This is compliance with the Federal No Surprises Act, and it includes requiring the Commissioner of Health to enforce balance billing requirements, modifying consumer balance billing protections, and expanding continuity of care for pregnant patients who change health plans. The next group is sections 7-9 and section 98. This is from House File 3696, the first engrossment. This makes changes to the all payer claims database by requiring the collection of data on non-claims based payments and modifying the allowable uses of the data. It also requires a report on healthcare spending across payment models. Section 10 is a governor's proposal. It reestablishes in statute the Advisory Council on Water Supply Systems and Wastewater Treatment Facilities. Section 11 is also a governor's proposal. It establishes an annual licensing base fee plus a per bed and per bassinet fee for hospitals, with the funds to be used for trauma hospital designations. Next group of sections, sections 12 to 15 and section 101, paragraph B, relate to loan forgiveness programs. And the bills that it pulls from that the sections pull from are House File 853, which makes acupuncture practitioners practicing in designated rural areas eligible for loan forgiveness under the Health Professional Education Loan Forgiveness Program. House File 3418, the first engrossment with some changes. This makes mental health professionals who provide clinical supervision in their designated field eligible for loan forgiveness under the program. House File 3860 language makes nurses who practice in a school setting eligible for loan forgiveness under the program. House File 3242, as amended with some changes, provides that nurses who agree to teach according to the requirements in the Health Professional Education Loan Forgiveness Program are exempt from program requirements regarding when the service obligation must begin and the maximum number of years of participation. Language from House File 4213 with a DE amendment. This changes a term used to define certain providers eligible for the Loan Forgiveness Program. And it expands eligibility for loan forgiveness to certain providers who work in a practice with at least 25% of their patients from an underserved patient population. And language from House File 4398 as amended, which is a governor's proposal, makes public health employees who work for a public health department in an area of high need eligible for loan forgiveness under the program. Moving to section 16, which is from House File 2715. This authorizes a home and community-based services provider who receives a grant from the HCBS Services Employee Scholarship Program to also provide loan forgiveness with those same funds. Section 17, which is from House File 3242, as amended with changes, establishes a hospital nursing loan forgiveness program. Sections 18, 19, and 22 are governor's proposals. These are healthcare workforce program proposals. They establish a health professionals rural and underserved clinical rotation grant program, a primary care rural residency training grant program, and a grant program to support clinical training for healthcare students in areas of high need where there are shortages of healthcare professionals. Sections 20 and 21 are from House File 3418. These are mental health workforce initiatives establishing the Mental Health Provider Supervision Grant Program and the Mental Health Professional Scholarship Grant Program. Section 23 is from House File 2663. This establishes procedures for the commissioner to and the courts to change the sex of an individual on a birth certificate at the request of the birth certificate subject, or at the request of the subject's parent or guardian if the subject is a minor. Section 24 is a governor's proposal. It authorizes the commissioner to maintain a database of lead service lines, provide technical assistance to community water systems, and ensure inventory data and education materials are accessible to the public. Section 25 is a governor's proposal. It modifies fees for department review and approval of engineering plans for healthcare facility construction and remodeling projects. So sections 26 through 30, 92, 95, and section 101 paragraph C are all from House File 3242 as amended. These sections require hospitals to establish hospital nursing staffing committees, require development, implementation, and public posting of hospital core staffing plans and documentation of compliance with core staffing plans, prohibit retaliation against hospital employees for certain conduct, and require the commissioner to collect data on the supply of nurses in the state and nurse retention. Section 31 is a governor's proposal. This is the Drug Overdose and Substance Abuse Prevention Initiative. It requires the commissioner to provide grants for 8 regional overdose prevention teams and to provide a grant for a homeless overdose prevention hub and to provide grants and contracts to support recovery-friendly work environments. Section 32 is from House File 3898. This lowers what constitutes an elevated blood lead level and triggers public health response activities under the Lead Poisoning Prevention Act. Section 33 is a governor's proposal. This is the Climate Resiliency Program. It directs the commissioner to establish a climate resiliency program and to issue grants to local organizations to plan for the health impacts of extreme weather events and develop adaptation actions. Section 34 is a governor's proposal. These are activities related to long COVID, requiring the commissioner to conduct community needs assessment and studies also requires the commissioner to establish a surveillance system to address long COVID and to identify and implement actions to support long COVID survivors and their families. Sections 35 through 37 are governor's proposals that require the commissioner to administer and oversee lifeline centers to answer calls to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Section 38 and section 101 paragraph D are from House File 3886, the first engrossment as amended. This is the Universal Voluntary Home Visiting Program for families expecting or caring for an infant. Section 39 is a governor's proposal. It authorizes the commissioner to administer a program to expand access to harm reduction services and provide linkages to care and to prevent infectious diseases in people experiencing homelessness or housing instability. Section 40 is a governor's proposal and also from House File 4099 as amended. The section establishes the Community Solutions for Healthy Child Development Program in statute, which was originally a temporary grant program established in 2020. And it was funded for fiscal years 2020 to 2023. Section 21 is a governor's proposal that establishes a grant program for remediation of lead sources in drinking water in schools and childcare settings. Section 42 is from House File 1419, the first division engrossment, and also a governor's proposal, which establishes a Skin Lightening Project's Public Awareness and Education Grant Program at MDH. Section 43 is a governor's proposal. Is the Community Health Worker Initiative. So it requires the commissioner to support collaboration to expand the community health worker workforce and directs the commissioner to issue a grant to a nonprofit community organization to expand that workforce. Section 44 is a governor's initiative regarding reducing health disparities among people with disabilities, requires the commissioner to coordinate with partners to address barriers to healthcare for people with disabilities, conduct a community needs assessment, and establish a health surveillance and tracking plan, also to issue grants and provide technical assistance. Section 45 is a governor's proposal. It allows the commissioner to award a grant to a nonprofit organization to support Public Health AmeriCorps members. Section 46, also a governor's proposal. This is the Healthy Beginnings, Healthy Families Act. This establishes a Minnesota collaborative to prevent infant mortality, authorizes grants to improve infant health, establishes the Help Me Connect online navigator to connect pregnant and parenting families with local services. It also authorizes a universal screening program to identify young children at risk for developmental and behavioral concerns and permits grants to implement model jail practices to prevent or to benefit children of incarcerated parents. Section 47 is a governor's proposal and also from House File 3114. This is the Minnesota School Health Initiative, which establishes a program to provide grants to support existing school-based health centers and establish new school-based health centers. Sections 48 through 50 are governor's proposals that modify the funding formula for community health centers to include funding for foundational public health responsibilities. Sections also specify uses of community health board funds for foundational public health responsibilities and provide grants to tribal governments. Sections 51 through 74 are from House File 1888, the second engrossment. These sections establish registration for transfer care specialists and authorizes them to transfer dead human bodies from the place of death to funeral establishments. These sections also extend the period of time a body may be kept in refrigeration before final disposition. Sections 75, 77, 81, 82, and 89 are from House File 4387 with an A3 amendment. These are changes to the medical cannabis program. The sections require the commissioner to increase the number of registered manufacturers, requires a manufacturer that is a business entity to be incorporated in Minnesota. Sections establish background study requirements for controlling persons of a manufacturer and require the commissioner to return part of an application fee if an applicant to be a manufacturer is not selected. Sections 76, 78 through 80 and 83 through 88 are from House File 3162, the second engrossment. This is the Tribal Medical Cannabis Program Bill. These sections permit a medical cannabis manufacturer to distribute to tribal medical cannabis program patients. Sections allow a tribal medical cannabis program to transport medical cannabis to testing laboratories and to other Indian lands. Also allow patients enrolled in the state medical cannabis program to receive medical cannabis from a tribal program and extend protections in state law to tribal medical cannabis program patients and employees. Section 89 is from House File 3119 with one change. It lowers patient enrollment fees for the medical cannabis program from $50 for patients who are enrolled in state public health care programs or receive certain disability payments, and $200 for all other patients to $40 for all patients. Sections 90 and 101, paragraph A, are from their governor's provisions and also from House File 4113. These are modifications to the Mental Health Cultural Community Continuing Education Grant Program. The modifications would allow grant funds to cover supervision costs for mental health professionals to become supervisors and supervision costs for practitioners pursuing professional licensure. Section 91 from House File 2499. This is a contract with University of Minnesota for a benefit and cost analysis of the legislative proposal for a universal healthcare financing system. Section 93 is from House File 2586 with the DE amendment. This establishes the Emmett Lewis Till Victims Recovery Program, requiring the commissioner to provide grants to community-based organizations for services for victims of trauma from government-sponsored activities and their families. Sections 94 and 96 are governor's proposals, and these sections require the commissioner to identify strategies to reduce administrative spending and low-value healthcare. Sections also require the commissioner to develop a plan to assess the readiness of rural healthcare providers to adopt value-based global budgeting or alternative payment systems and to recommend steps for implementation. Section 97 is from House File 3862 as amended by a DE amendment. This section directs the commissioner to distribute COVID-19 tests, masks, and respirators to individuals in the state. Section 99 is a governor's proposal. It requires the commissioner to distribute grants to state-licensed long-term care facilities for projects to improve the safety, quality of care, and livability of facilities. And finally, Section 100 is from House File 3660. This is a study of the development of a statewide registry for provider orders for life-sustaining treatment. And that concludes Article 1.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Sunderman. There's a little bit of work in there. Obviously yours and a lot of people. So questions from members, anything technical for Ms. Sunderman? All right, not seeing anything, so we can move on to Article 2. And members, if you have your either a paper copy as I do, or you're looking at it online, Article 2 begins on page 103. So, Ms. Sunderman, is that you, or are we going to Mr. Chun?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Chun, thank you.
So Article 2 is the Department of Health policy article. So it begins on page 103 of the Delete All Amendment. Section 1 is House File 3975. It deals with nursing home resident assessment schedules. It specifies two circumstances in which a significant change of status assessment is not required. Sections 2 and 3 are from House File 4000. These change the definition of byproduct material in sections that govern radioactive materials. Then sections 4 and 65 are from House File 4112. These change the membership of the Rural Health Advisory Committee, also established the Health Equity Advisory and Leadership Council at the Health Department. Section 5 is from House File 4214. It eliminates certain data posting and reporting requirements related to ST elevation, myocardial infarction response, treatment, and outcomes. Then Sections 6 and 76 are House File 2812. They provide an exception to the hospital construction moratorium for North Shore Health in Grand Marais. Also require the commissioner to provide recommendations and whether similar exceptions should be authorized for other hospitals. Then Section 6 is House File 3470, provides an exception to the hospital moratorium for Children's Hospital in St. Paul, authorizing addition of beds for pediatric inpatient behavioral health services. Then Section 7 is House File 3874. This excludes dental clinics and offices that perform diagnostic imaging using dental cone beam computerized tomography from the definition of diagnostic imaging facility. So it's an exemption from certain annual reporting requirements. Then Section 8 is House File 4063. Requires hospitals before they discharge a patient who is uninsured or whose insurance status is not known to screen the patient for eligibility for charity care, public health care programs, and premium tax credits. Then sections 9, 23, 24, 20, and 26 to 64 modify a requirement for electronic monitoring of residents of certain long-term care settings. They also modify the membership and duties of the Home Care and Assisted Living Program Advisory Council and modify provisions that govern assisted living facilities. Then section 10 is House File 4025. It amends the Healthcare Bill of Rights to require healthcare facilities and providers to allow at least one designated support person with a pregnant patient that is receiving healthcare services. Sections 11 and 77 are from House File 3871. They make changes to the cancer reporting system, allowing health department staff to interview cancer patients after notification of the provider. It allows the cancer reporting system to share certain data with other state and national cancer registries. Then sections 12 to 16 are House File 3873. They modify definitions of certain types of lead work in the Lead Poisoning Prevention Act. They modify activities that may be conducted without a license or certification to perform lead work. Then sections 17 to 22 and 77 are from House File 4573. They modify nursing home licensure statutes related to changes of ownership. Then section 25 is from House File 3148, modifies the definition of palliative care in the hospice care statutes. Then section 66 is from House File 4001, requires the commissioner to receive an individual's application to work as a guest tattoo technician, guest body piercing technician, or guest body art technician at least 14 days before the applicant conducts the body art procedure. Then sections 67 to 75 are from House File 3876. They make changes to the medical cannabis statutes, require implementation of a state centralized electronic database, require laboratories to collect or contract for the collection of cannabis samples from the manufacturer, and modify provisions related to transportation. And that's the end of the walkthrough for Article 2.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chun. And Mr. McQuillan also reminds me that in our documents, document 4 is a bill list. So that is another way for members to follow along. I know it can be very confusing to go through omnibus bills. And just for the public and for members who may be newer to this process, what makes this, I think, really confusing for people who aren't used to this is that the bill always is written with the sections in the order in which they would occur in the statutes. And that's why sections of bills that members may have submitted that we may have heard in committee, we find them sometimes in different sections of the omnibus bill, and it can be confusing for that reason. So that bill list that is posted with our documents may be of assistance to members as we go through this. So I think we're now on Article 3, and is Mr. Chun, is that sure. Still you?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
Please proceed.
Madam Chair, Article 3 is the healthcare finance article. So it begins on page 170 of the Delete All Amendment. Sections 1 to 8 and 55 are from House File 4430. These establish a healthcare affordability board that's authorized to set healthcare spending growth targets for a five-year period, to require performance improvement plans and take other steps to reduce healthcare spending increases. And the board is also required to establish an Office of Consumer Protection. Then a number of sections 9, 11, 26, 34 to 36, 38, 39, and 56 are from House File 3365. These eliminate cost sharing under MA and Minnesota Care, effective January 1 of 2023. Then section 10 is House File 3839. This requires DHS to include information on dental provider enrollment in their annual reports that they submit on dental utilization. Sections 12, 25, 27, and 40 are from House File 3153. They expand MA coverage of tobacco and nicotine cessation services. The changes include covering phone counseling through a quit line, expanding eligible providers, and eliminating certain prior authorization volume and cost sharing requirements. Then section 13 is House File 4576. This is a governor's recommendation. Provides MA coverage for former foster care youth who had been enrolled in Medicaid in another state. Sections 14, 48, and 49, also governor's recommendations. These make various changes in eligibility and other procedures for healthcare programs related to the transition from the public health emergency. Then section 15 is House File 2773. This increases the income limit and spend down limit for persons who are elderly or have disabilities so that the limits are 133% of the poverty guidelines effective July 1 of 2025. Section 16, this is House File 4576, provides continuous eligibility for 12 months for children under MA. Section 17 is House File 3147. This expands adult dental coverage under MA by removing language that specified that coverage was limited just to specified services. Then sections 18 and 19 are from House File 3691, in modified form. This allows MA to provide mileage reimbursement for non-emergency medical transportation and ambulance services. And this reimbursement would be adjusted to reflect increases and decreases in the price of gasoline. Sections 20 and 21 are from House File 4062. They provide MA coverage using state-only funds for hospice, respite, and end-of-life care for children who receive care in a facility that is not Medicare certified. Then Section 22 is from House File 4576. It's a governor's proposal. Allows doula agencies and individual doulas to be directly reimbursed under MA. Section 23 is another governor's proposal. It requires DHS to establish an alternative payment method for tribal federally qualified health centers. Then Section 24 is House File 3958, provides MA coverage for seizure detection devices. Then Sections 28, 30 to 32 and 33 allow MA enrollees to opt out of managed care effective January 1 of 2023. Section 29, this is new language, requested by DHS. It specifies the procedures to be followed by the department if the waiver that allows federal Medicaid funding to be used for medical education or research is not renewed. Then section 37 is from House File 4576. It's a governor's proposal that allows MA to reimburse for the Department of Health fees for newborn screenings that occur in an outpatient setting. Then sections 41 to 46 and 51 to 53 are from House File 11. These establish a Minnesota Care public option effective January 1 of 2025. They extend or continue the lower Minnesota Care premiums that were under effect with the federal American Rescue Plan. They provide eligibility for undocumented children, require DHS to submit an implementation plan for the public option to the legislature. Then section 47 is from House File 4576. It's a governor's proposal. It requires DHS to continue to provide periodic data matching grants to the counties. Section 50 is House File 4472, requires the commissioner to establish a dental home pilot project. And then section 54 is from House File 3717, requires DHS to report to the legislature to compare current service delivery and payment systems for MA and Minnesota Care with at least two alternative models. And that is the walkthrough for Article 3.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chan. I will just pause for a moment to see if there are any technical questions for members. Okay, not seeing any, so I think we can go on to Article 4.
Okay. Right, so Madam Chair, Article 4 is the healthcare policy article. So that starts on page 251 of the bill. And these sections 1 to 11, the entire article is all from House File 3636. So this is the DHS healthcare policy bill, and it makes changes to healthcare program administration, including changes related to the managed care ombudsperson, children in foster care, telehealth, and also MA trust and annuity language.
Okay, thank you. Questions about Article 4? All right, not seeing any. And Ms. Sunderman, I assume that you, because you turned on your video, are ready to go next. Please proceed.
Madam Chair and members, I'll be walking through Article 5, the Health-Related Licensing Boards article. This is starting on page 265 of the bill. Let's see, sections 1 through 6 are from House File 2743, the first engrossment. These are the practice supervision requirements for licensed professional clinical counselors, marriage and family therapists, and social workers, allowing for remote supervision with two-way interactive video. Sections 7 through 17 and 21 are from House File 3560, the first engrossment. These are the Board of Dentistry sections, modifying specialty and guest dentist licensure, allowing dental therapy licensure by credentials, making various clarifying changes, and then combining and modifying fees. Section 18 is House File 2768. This is allowing pharmacists to administer drugs via intramuscular and subcutaneous administration, and to also place drug monitoring devices. Section 19 is House File 3099. This is the podiatrist licensure one, which changes a date relating to the exemption from residency program requirements. And finally, Section 20 is from House File 3691 as amended by a DE, and it's one section of the DE that provides temporary requirements governing ambulance service operations and emergency medical services. And that concludes Article 5.
All right, thank you, Ms. Sunderman. Okay, Article 6, prescription drugs, and we are on page 284.
So, Madam Chair, the first bill is House File 58. These are a range of sections 1 through 3, 5, 7, 9, 11, 13, 22, 43, and 51. They require health plans to file drug formularies with the Commissioner of Commerce. They require 90 days notice of price changes for formulary drugs with prices that are above a certain specified threshold. They establish requirements for formulary changes made by health plans. Then Section 4 is some House File 4504. This modifies and clarifies the existing health department reporting requirements for drug manufacturers. Section 6, 8, 10, 12, and 14 to 21 are from House File 4398. Those extend the current health department reporting requirements for drugs beyond manufacturers to also include reporting by pharmacies, pharmacy benefit managers, and wholesalers. It also allows the health department to establish reporting requirements for drugs that the department determines represent a substantial public interest. Then sections 23 to 28, 50 and 52 are House File 1183. They prohibit drug manufacturers from imposing excessive price increases, require manufacturers to report information related to these increases, and also allow the Attorney General and the Board of Pharmacy to take action in cases of violations. Then sections 29 to 39 are from House File 801. They require the Commissioner of Commerce to establish a prescription drug affordability board. The board is allowed to conduct cost reviews of drugs that exceed certain cost thresholds and make this information public. And the board is also allowed to set upper payment limits for drugs that create an affordability challenge. And the AG is also allowed to take action. Then sections 40, 42, 46, 47, 54, 57, and 58 are House File 3854. This is the PrEP or PEP bill. It allows pharmacists that meet specified criteria to prescribe and administer drugs to prevent HIV subject to standardized protocols. Requires health plans and the public health care programs to cover these drugs, provides non-discrimination provisions, and prohibits MA and Minnesota Care from requiring prior authorization or step therapy. Then section 41 is House File 2056, just section one of that. This limits health plan cost sharing requirements for enrollees for prescription drugs and related medical supplies that are prescribed to treat diabetes and other chronic diseases. Sections 44, 48, 49, and 59 are from House File 1516. They prohibit PBMs and health carriers from requiring or demonstrating a preference for a biological product and also make related changes. House File 45 is House File 3280. This is the white bagging provision. It prohibits a PBM or health carrier from requiring that a clinician-administered drug be covered as a pharmacy benefit and makes related changes. Then House File 53 is from House File 1158. This modifies language that was enacted last year to require mail order pharmacies to include in each order that they ship out a device that allows the patient to detect improper storage or temperature violations. Then House File 55 is House File 3924. This provides funding to the Central Repository to administer the Medication Repository Program. Then Section 56 is House File 3786. This modifies the criteria and procedures for prescribing or administering controlled substances to treat intractable pain. And that concludes Article 6.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chan. And once again, I hope members can really be aware of how much work you've put into getting all of this together for us today. Okay, so I think we are ready to move on. Well, are there questions for members, first of all? All right, not seeing any. So let's move on to Article 7.
All right, so Madam Chair, Article 7, this is the health insurance article, starts on page 362 of the bill. So sections 1, 3, 5, and 8 are from House File 2915. Requires health plans, MA, and Minnesota Care to cover the treatment of ectodermal dysplasias, including reconstructive breast surgery, hair prostheses, and dental services. Section 2 is House File 56. Requires health plans to include coverage for lymphedema, including certain treatments and medical items. Then sections 4, 9, and 10 are House File 447. Requires health plans, MA, and Minnesota Care to cover, without enrollee cost sharing, additional diagnostic services or testing after a mammogram if a healthcare provider believes this is necessary. Then sections 6 and 7 are House File 626, prohibits a health plan company, MA, or Minnesota Care from restricting the choice of where an enrollee receives services, the diagnosis, monitoring, and treatment of a rare disease or condition. And that is Article 7.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chan. On to Article 8, miscellaneous, the mystery article.
Yeah. So Article 8, this is miscellaneous, starts on page 367. So sections 1, 3 to 9, and 12 are House File 3595. And these sections establish requirements for products containing cannabinoids, including limiting the amount of THC products may contain, prohibiting products containing THC from being sold to persons under 21, modifying, testing, and labeling requirements, and establishing requirements for edible products. Then sections 2 and 20 are House File 3676. They move the Rare Disease Advisory Council from the University of Minnesota to the Board of to the Board of Regents and makes related changes. House sections 10 to 17 and 19 are House File 1023. They reschedule marijuana and non-synthetic tetrahydrocannabinols from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2. Then Section 18 is House File 3972. They prohibit healthcare providers and organ procurement organizations from making decisions about access to anatomical gifts and related services based on race and ethnicity. And let me just mention the other remaining articles since they're very short. Article 9 is just the forecast adjustment article. And then Article 10, that is the appropriations article. We won't go over that since it was covered in the walkthrough of the spreadsheet.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chan. And I do just want to acknowledge as well that Elizabeth Barkvist is not able to be here for this hearing, but a lot of the sections she covers the public health and I think she and also the health related boards, if I'm not mistaken. But a lot of the work in this bill is hers as well. So I just want to, even though she isn't here to do the walkthrough right now because she's working on other important work for us, I just want to acknowledge that. So members, do you have any technical questions for House research staff before we turn to our testimony that we have today? All right, not seeing any. There definitely is a lot here, and I'm grateful that we have testifiers here to, who are going to speak to us, and we welcome their comments, and we will, so we will turn to them. I think we have, now some of them, just to sort of set the table here, we have quite a few people who signed up to testify. We also have documents that have been submitted for the committee. I do want to mention that to members that we do have those and we will be reviewing those. I know I will, I hope other members will as well. We have tried to ask our testifiers to designate which articles they're testifying on just to try to keep it logical for members. Some of them wish to testify on numerous articles, so I will just ask our testifiers, if when you testify, just please make sure that we know what part of the bill or what, it's not so important to tell us what article you're on as it is to tell us the subject that you're testifying about so that we're able to listen to your testimony and understand what you're trying to convey to us. So that would be my ask of the testifiers. Also, because we have a lot of people who want to testify, we're asking testifiers to please limit your testimony to 2 minutes or 5 minutes total if you're testifying on multiple articles. So with that, the very first testifier who I have on the list is Maria Huntley. And welcome to the committee. And please introduce yourself. So I won't repeat this for everyone, but please introduce yourself, tell us your name, who you represent, and then go right into your testimony. So welcome.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and committee members. My name is Mariah Huntley. I am the CEO of the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians. The MAFP is the largest physician specialty organization in Minnesota, representing more than 3,100 family physicians, residents, and medical students from across our state. Family physicians provide comprehensive primary care across the lifespan, serving as the entry point for most patients' healthcare needs and helping coordinate care with other specialists. In Minnesota, more than 50% of physicians practicing in small rural communities are family doctors, and more than 66% of physicians practicing in isolated areas are family doctors. Today, I'm here to testify in strong support for the update to the All Payer Claims Database, also known as the APCD, to ensure that it collects a complete picture on how healthcare is paid for in Minnesota. And I believe this, this is in Article 1, per your request, Chairman. Currently, as you know, the APCD only collects payments that are claims-based. Those payments represent the transactional care done in fee-for-service. But as the way we pay for healthcare is changing, it is missing a large portion of payments. Non-claims-based payments. These payments include value-based payments, infrastructure cost, complex care coordination, and other patient support services. Value-based payments support primary care physicians and other providers caring for patients with increasing complexity, patients with multiple complex chronic diseases and/or a multitude of social determinants of health. They support the infrastructure we need to allow our healthcare teams to address population health, prevention, and management of chronic conditions with a focus on trying to address the many health disparities that exist in our state. The language authorizes the Department of Health to begin collecting non-claims-based payment information in 2024. In the interim, the bill directs the department to develop a report by February 2023 on the percentage of total payments that are non-claims based and the percentage of payments that are for primary care services. Without this additional data, how do we, all of us here, develop and set a vision for a healthcare system that works for Minnesotans and is aligned with the quadruple aim? MAFP strongly supports the initiatives to begin to address primary care workforce in Minnesota by providing training grants to clinical education for medical students, pharmacists, dentists, advanced practice nurses, and more, including funding for rural primary care residency training and expanded loan forgiveness programs. The focus of these grants is to train healthcare workers to practice in high need and professional shortage areas. Expanding our primary care workforce is about more than just increasing the supply. It's about reinvigorating the practice of team-based primary care to keep the number of physicians we have and to make the profession more attractive to young physicians, especially in rural Minnesota. Thank you for your support of these efforts to better understand the funding of and to strengthen primary care. Minnesota's family physicians and healthcare workers are working hard to take care of all the people of our state, and your efforts to ensure that they are supported is appreciated. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And we do appreciate our primary care practitioners very much. Okay, next on the agenda is Patty Bowler. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Patty Bowler, and I'm the Director of Policy and Healthy Communities for the Minneapolis Health Department. And I also serve as the legislative co-chair for the Local Public Health Association of Minnesota. LPHA represents local public health departments from across all of our 87 counties, as well as tribes and cities. And I also wanted to give a shout out to Local Public Health because this is National Public Health Week. Thank you for including the numerous provisions in this bill that will help local public health best serve their communities. And I wanted to highlight a few of the provisions of highest priority. First, thank you for investing in the public health system transformation. This is Article 1, Section 48. Our health departments have varying capacities across the state, and this $23.5 million investment will help local and tribal public health departments have foundational capabilities in place ensuring that they're always ready to serve their communities and achieve equitable health outcomes. We also appreciate the inclusion of the local and tribal public health emergency preparedness provision, which is Article 10, Section 3. And thank you to Representative Hewitt for his leadership on this. Emergency preparedness is a mandated responsibility of local public health. And historically, we've only received funding from the federal government for this component. And with funding cuts over time at the federal level, this state investment will ensure that we're prepared to respond to emergencies from things like COVID-19 to natural disasters. We'd also like to thank you for the provision that addresses the public health workforce challenges that we're facing. And these provisions expand the role of the community health worker, Article 1, Section 43, and funding the Public Health AmeriCorps program, which is Article 1, Section 45. Finally, we support the inclusion of child-focused provisions that ensure Minnesota's children get a healthy start in the earliest years of their life. We support numerous provisions, including the creation of universal voluntary home visiting, Article 1, Section 38, Healthy Beginnings, Healthy Families, Article 1, Section 46, and strengthening the role of school health, Article 1, Section 47. So thank you for your support for the local public health system.
All right, thank you very much for your testimony. Next on the list, we have Nancy Jost. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Nancy Jost, and I'm the Director of Early Childhood at West Central Initiative, based out of Fergus Falls. And I'm also the co-chair of the Minnesota Prenatal to Three Coalition and a member of the Family Home Visiting Coalition. Both the Prenatal to Three Coalition and the Family Home Visiting Coalition support House File 4706. Collectively, we are excited to see significant investments in Minnesota's youngest children, their families, and their caregivers. We strongly support the Community Solutions Fund for Healthy Child Development. We support the family home visiting, the voluntary home, family home visiting services for every infant in Minnesota. We support Healthy Beginnings, Healthy Families Initiative. We support the investments in mental health services for little children, their families, and the early childhood education workforce. We support the removal of doula supervision requirements. And finally, we support including lead testing, lead remediation, and grants for elevated lead blood levels. And then I would like to just leave you today with an image. I would like you to imagine that you're holding a baby and we're looking at that baby in our arms and thinking about how they develop, and they are so dependent on adults for everything, in fact, for their life. We think about their little brain that is growing faster than it will ever grow again in a person's life. That little brain is building the foundation for that little baby's entire lifetime. Now imagine while you're holding that baby that sitting beside you is $9 billion as a surplus in Minnesota. And imagine looking at that baby, and can we say in all honesty to that baby that we can't afford to help you get off to the best start in life possible? Can we look at the adults who love and care for that baby and say we can't afford to help you to care for and nurture that baby the best that you can? Can we look at the early childhood care and educators that care for and educate those little babies that we can't afford to support you? I urge you as legislators to think about that baby in the next few days and weeks as you're making decisions about the way we spend the money in Minnesota and what our priorities are. And I just urge you to think about that baby every time you vote. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Jost. I can't help but mention that one of our members probably literally is holding a baby, her new baby granddaughter, I think daughter. Yeah, Charlotte, I believe. And so interesting that you bring us that image today. Thank you for your testimony. Okay, we have Zhang Vang Li. Committee.
Great. Good afternoon, Chair Li Wing and members of the committee. My name is Zhang Vang Li. I am a parent and a member of the Hmong Early Childhood Coalition. I am here today to express gratitude and support the inclusion of the Community Solutions Grant Program in House File 4706, Article 1. I got involved with Hmong Early Childhood Coalition about 12 years ago because as a young mom, I did not have the necessary resources and tools to advocate for my children and family. Hmong Early Childhood Coalition was only able to provide limited support as members of the coalition are all dedicated individuals who volunteer their time before or after their workday. Since receiving the Community Solutions Grant, we have been able to expand our work with Hmong families and communities. We have shifted to virtual spaces to provide opportunities for networking, support, and share resources. We've provided culturally responsive monthly trainings, allowing licensed early childhood educators to meet their requirements to continue their family childcare businesses. We've also increased our capacity by adding another approved Hmong trainer through Achieve, the Minnesota Center for Professional Development, and continue to work with other early educators to become approved trainers. The Community Solutions Grant Program is a model that truly centers around community and understands the importance of community voice and the work of small community-led organizations such as Hmong Early Childhood Coalition. I wanna thank you for the opportunity to share my story today and for supporting the Community Solutions Grant Program. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony today. Okay, I have Andrea Martinez, or Andrea, welcome. Please go ahead, introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Hi, thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Andrea Martinez. I am the Family Systems Project Manager at CLUS, a Latino-led organization here in Minnesota. Our work is to ensure the advancement of social and economic equity and well-being for the Latino community. And I'm here today to express gratitude and support for the inclusion of the Community Solutions Grant Program in House File 4706, Article 1. As part of our community empowerment efforts and with the help of the Community Solutions Grant, we recruited a group of Latinx parents who helped us create culturally relevant interventions to support Latinx children to thrive. This group led the creation of our program, Sembrando Éxitos, Sowing Success, based on the community's needs. Through this program, parents and caregivers participate in a learning cohort about early childhood with content culturally tailored to the Latino community. Additionally, we collaborate with them to identify the main barriers Latino families face to accessing high quality services of early care and education, such as language, income, and transportation. We believe that parents and caregivers are the experts of their own experiences and children. Therefore, they must be a pillar component in our program's design, evaluation, and implementation. Community Solutions has allowed us to provide support services to the families so they can be fully engaged in this initiative. Participants have reported that this program has helped them strengthen their skills as first teachers and advocates for their children, and has provided a safe space for them to learn in community. Community Solutions has centered the voice of Latinx families by creating culturally relevant spaces and leadership opportunities to empower parents and caregivers to support their children's development and learning process. As a grantee, CLUS, Community Solutions has given us the opportunity to learn directly from the Latinx families, identify root causes, and advocate for systemic change. Thank you for listening and for your support to the Community Solutions Grant.
All right, thank you very much for your testimony. The next on my list is Mary Turner. Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Mary C. Turner. I am the elected president of Minnesota Nurses Association, which represents 22,000 nurses across the state and roughly 80% of all bedside hospital nurses in Minnesota. I am also a COVID ICU nurse in a metropolitan hospital. About a month or so ago, I was rounding in one of the major hospitals up in Duluth. And as I was checking on the nurses, seeing how they're doing, and as I went to leave the acute care floor that mainly took care of the COVID, I had a young nurse that followed me. And we got to the elevators and she looked very, very distressed. I asked her what was wrong. She promptly burst into tears. I held her as she cried on my shoulder. And she proceeded to tell me how she had only been a nurse for 7 months, but that she was so discouraged and so demoralized that she was seriously thinking of getting out of the profession. Now, I have listened to multiple stories like this over the last 7 years that I've been president of Minnesota Nurses Association. And I'm here to tell you today that we are at a critical moment for our healthcare system in Minnesota. There's a crisis in our hospitals. Nurses are overworked, overwhelmed, and understaffed. Patients are overcharged because hospitals management is putting patient care in the backseat of their bottom lines. The COVID-19 pandemic did not create these problems. Nurses have been raising the alarm about understaffing in our hospitals and the effect on patient care for years. But this incident with this nurse was not just raising the alarm. This was a desperate cry for help because our young nurses are leaving the bedside faster than we can get them at the bedside. And I want to thank today Chair Liebling for hearing that cry for help. I want to thank you for putting in Article 1, the Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act, which is our best chance to stabilize our healthcare system in Minnesota. And I want to express my deep gratitude for Chair Liebling, including this important legislation in the HH Omnibus Bill. You will have my undying gratitude. The chair's work on prioritizing this hyper-local proposal, which would put nurses and hospital managers at the table together to set staff levels, will help nurses stay on the job to provide safe, excellent care that patients deserve. It would also provide funding for mental health services and loan forgiveness programs to retain more nurses. Another aspect of Article 1 that MNA supports: we have always been advocates for single-payer healthcare system, which we believe that healthcare should be accessible to all Minnesotans without exception. Every day, nurses see the consequences of a system designed to prioritize profits over the care of people. As such, we support proposals that work towards making sure Minnesotans have access to things like food, healthcare coverage, and that there are adequate staff to help care for Minnesotans who need it. The study of implementing a Minnesota health plan and the Healthcare Affordability Council and Board are important steps for changing the healthcare system to ensure Minnesotans have the high quality and accessible healthcare. There are so many great programs and investments throughout this bill, and we applaud you all for working to help nurses stay on the job to provide safe, excellent care that patients deserve and that we want to give them. Thank you for this opportunity to testify this afternoon.
Thank you very much for your testimony, President Turner. Appreciate having you here today. Next, I have Kay Greenlee. Welcome to the committee.
Hello, Chair Liebling and committee members. My name is Kay Greenlee, and I'm the Vice President of Performance Excellence at CenterCare. I've been a nurse for over 40 years. I am here this afternoon to express my concerns with the staffing ratio requirements for hospitals in HF 4706, Article 1, Sections 26 through 30. CenterCare has demonstrated their commitment to people of our workforce, regardless of their role, but certainly including nurses. We invested to keep them whole from a pay perspective during the first surge, and even if they weren't working, CenterCare providing scheduled incentives when we needed them more, retention bonuses to keep them with us when their skills were demanded elsewhere in the state or the nation. And we said thank you with a COVID award for hanging in there last May and again this past January. We did these things for our people, but mostly for the patients we serve to assure we were staffed and able to provide excellent care in the right place at the right time. Additionally, to ensure the best possible care for our patients and a positive work environment, St. Cloud Hospital, for example, has a staffing committee comprised of frontline workers, including nurses, who serve in various capacities to assure a comprehensive approach to staffing. We did this because it's the right thing to do. We didn't and don't need this legislation. The experience over the past 2 years has taught us a lot about how to work together across departments in one hospital and across many hospitals within a system or a region to serve the people of Minnesota, many of them from rural communities. The flexibility and innovation used to staff our hospitals during, before, during, and after the surges of the pandemic saved lives. I can't imagine how the outcome for the people of Minnesota would have been different if this legislation would have been in place. Thanks for the opportunity to testify this afternoon, and I'll be available for any questions.
All right, thank you for your testimony. We have Mary Krinke, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. My comments today are going to focus on Article 1 and Article 3, and starting out with Article 1, Sections 26 through 30, which mandates that all hospitals must have a staffing committee and empowers this committee to make the staffing decisions for a hospital, specifically on line 43.8. A hospital must implement the core staffing plans approved by a majority vote of the hospital nurse staffing committee. This fundamentally changes operations of a hospital, moving current staffing decisions from nurse management to a committee, which may or may not have the expertise to know the full breadth of hospital operations or the experience and availability of other healthcare team members. For example, does the hospital have physicians on staff, respiratory therapists, pharmacists, or nursing assistants? The language instructs this committee to set a maximum number of patients that a registered nurse can care for on each inpatient care unit. This approach does not recognize the needs of the individual patient or the experience of the nurse. The language says that hospitals must have a process to allow employees or patients to submit anonymous concerns related to safe staffing. But safe staffing is not defined in the bill. Is it considered unsafe if a hospital needs to admit a new patient and it is above the staffing ratio? Hospitals need flexibility to care for patients, and sometimes this means moving staff around to where it is most needed. The last 2 years have been extremely stressful for everyone involved in healthcare. And while this bill does contain many good provisions in other sections, like helping with loan forgiveness and mental health grants, this language will stifle innovation, reduce flexibility, add costs, and most harmful, potentially limit a hospital's ability to admit patients who need our care. I'd like to move on quickly to Article 3, Sections 2 through 7, and another section as well. In this section, the language creates an affordability board and advisory council charged with establishing healthcare spending growth targets. MHA has concerns with such a broad policy and regulatory body. Rather than creating this new entity, the Health Economics Department at the Minnesota Department of Health could be used to accomplish similar research and healthcare spending trend analysis. The language charges this new somewhat political entity to review performance improvement plans if a healthcare provider exceeds its spending target. The language goes even farther to give this new affordability board the ability to issue civil penalties. Civil penalties is a dollar amount that could be charged to a healthcare provider if they exceed their spending growth target. And the last area I want to mention today is the Minnesota Care buy-in for low-income individuals. And I want to be clear, the Minnesota Hospital Association has long supported Minnesota Care, and we continue to do so for low-income individuals. It might be time to look at the eligibility threshold, and maybe that income limit should be raised. But to allow anyone to buy into Minnesota Care without an upper income limit threshold could be very damaging to all healthcare providers and would not be sustainable in our healthcare system. So we would urge you to go extremely slow in that area and to look at the payment rates between commercial payers and our public programs. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and look forward to working with the committee as this bill moves through the process. Thank you.
Thank you for next. Kelly Hagan, welcome. And you are muted.
All right, is that better? Sorry about that.
Yes.
Chair Liebling and members of the committee, my name is Kelly Hagan. I'm Vice President of Nursing and Clinical Services at Sanford Bemidji Medical Center, serving rural northwestern Minnesota. I've been a nurse leader for about 25 years and was a frontline nurse for many years. We do have a collective bargaining with the MNA here in Bemidji. Our nurses do participate in a staffing and scheduling committee. On our staffing and scheduling committee, half of the members are our frontline nurses and half are our nurse leaders. In addition, we come together no less than four times a day to discuss and reassess staffing needs and patient needs. We do not need legislation to dictate how we care for our patients. My passion as a nurse leader is for our patients and our nurses, our staff. It is to provide the very best care for our patients. To do that, I need to ensure that we provide a great place for our nurses to work, and that includes everything that impacts them, not just one thing. If a nurse leaves work sick one day, I need to bring in others. I try to do that to the best of our ability. Sometimes that's not possible. Sometimes we have to look at how we come together to provide the care that we need to provide. In Bemidji, we employ most of the nurses in our area, not only registered nurses, but licensed practical nurses as well. Our staffing and scheduling committee gives us the flexibility to consider the acuity of our patient and the talent of our nurse. It also allows us to meet the unique needs of each staff member by rallying a team around them to support life events. Ola Finley, a nurse at Sanford Bemidji, had a family that were in the Ukraine when war broke out. Because we were a family, our teams rallied around Ola to allow her the time she needed and the support to allow her family a way to escape and to have a safe landing in America. Her team covered her and helped her realize her family's safety. If we were held to specific ratios, this type of support and the ability to cover for our folks would not happen. Ola notes, I'm just so happy with my colleagues, the Sanford family. We are really like family over here. This could happen to anyone at any time. And this approach really takes away the family that we have in making these types of sensitive decisions and covering the folks we need. Putting ratios in place would not allow those things to happen. I encourage each of you to seek out and read Ola's story. It was covered in the media extensively. This bill implies that we are not connected and not working intentionally toward the same goal, providing the nursing care appropriate to meet the needs to care for our patients. This is not a simple math equation. This is a work of care, compassion, and commitment to ensure we are doing our utmost to meet the care needs of our patients and also ensure that the care required is matched with the skill of the nurse. Yes, as others have noted, we have challenges. Our communities have not helped us to provide the care that we need by impacting stressors that have really challenged the work and the science that we have imparted around caring for our community. It takes collegiality and connections, discussion, and the ability to be nimble to constantly regard and react to the continuous changes in the environment of healthcare delivery. This bill ties the hands of hospitals and health systems beyond the four walls of the hospital and limits the patients that we can care for. Currently, we submit our staffing plans to MHA. And at Sanford, we are working on the front lines of embedding technology and AI to predict and anticipate our patient care needs so we are nimble and can react quickly to the ever-changing environment. In closing, I will assert that all patients are different. All nurses are different. It is an unfortunate belief that each patient's care is equivalent or requires the same amount of time and skill. This way of thinking makes each patient a widget, when in reality, we know that some patients require less and some require more care. Requiring a committee to come up with an equation of a solid ratio will not ensure that safe quality of care.
I need you to wrap it up. Oh,
thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Okay. Dr. Rice, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to testify on a few key items included in the Health and Human Services Bill. My name is Dr. Randy Rice. I am a family medicine physician practicing in Moose Lake, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Medical Association, which represents more than 11,000 physicians and physicians in training. In Article 1, there are three items to highlight. First, I want to thank you for including the work to develop a statewide registry for patients who have a provider order for life-sustaining treatment, or PULSED form. PULSED forms are a critical tool for physicians and patients to express the patient's preferences for the type of treatment they want in end-of-life care. Without a statewide registry, however, their wishes will not get followed if the emergency room or EMT does not have access to a physical copy of the form. A PULSED registry will help ensure that the patient's important decisions are respected and followed by all healthcare providers. The MMA also supports the all-payer claims database changes to authorize the collection of non-claims-based payment information. As more payers are using value-based payments that may not be included in a claim, we are not collecting a complete picture of how healthcare is being paid for. And I would echo and support the comments made by Mariah Huntley for the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians, which was well presented there. I also thank you for providing funding for new primary care rural residency training grants. As a rural physician, I can tell you that we have a great need for additional physicians and other healthcare providers throughout the state. According to the Association of American Medical Colleges, an additional 14,100 to 17,600 physicians are needed across the country to address the shortage in rural areas. By locating training in rural areas, we can expose more future physicians to rural practice. I am an example of how this can work, as I grew up in the Twin Cities, but I've been practicing in rural Minnesota for almost 29 years now. Moving on to Article 3, the MMA strongly supports the coverage of tobacco cessation services in our public programs. Tobacco and nicotine use continues to be the number one preventable cause of disease and death in the state. And then lastly, in Article 6, the MMA strongly supports two items. Thank you again for including language to protect patients with ongoing medication needs. We support limiting insurer and pharmacy benefit managers from forcing patients to change the drug therapy in the middle of the enrollment year. A patient is bound by a contract to remain with their insurer for the entire enrollment year. The insurer should be bound by the same contract to continue coverage for the entire enrollment year as well. This will protect patients who often select their insurance plan based on the medications it covers. Imagine how disruptive it is for patients when an insurer changes its formulary during the middle of the contract year. This practice can be very harmful to patients, and I appreciate the inclusion of language addressing mid-year formulary changes in this legislation. Finally, the MMA supports the language that protects patients with chronic pain to ensure that they can continue to receive the medications they need to function. In the effort to reduce the overuse and abuse of opioids, patients with ongoing opioid needs have been forced to taper their medications, even when not clinically appropriate. This language balances the goals of reducing opioid overuse with the acknowledgement that patients with chronic pain can be managed with ongoing opioids and need access to these medications. Madam Chair, there are many other important provisions in this bill, but in the interest of time, I would just like to thank the committee for all the work to address the health and human services needs across Minnesota. I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
All right. Thank you very much for testimony, Dr. Rice. Okay. Next, we have Sue Abderholden. Welcome to the committee. Ms. Abderholden, I don't see you here. Okay. I don't know if she's here, so I think what we'll do then is go on to the next testifier, and if we see her, we will fit her in. So David Dively, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is, for the record, my name is David Dively, and I am the Executive Director for the Minnesota Council on Disability. Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of this committee for the following provisions. I'll try to keep this brief. I know there's many testifiers. First, I'm speaking today in favor of the provisions in Article 1, Section 44. This creates a program and funds the Reducing Health Disparities Among People with Disabilities effort. This is consistent with the National Council on Disabilities recently published 2022 Health Equity Framework to improve outcomes for people with disabilities. We saw the need for evidence-based accurate counts for Minnesotans with disabilities during the COVID-19 pandemic with enormous health disparities, such as IDD being the number one indicator of hospitalization from COVID-19. We fully support this initiative and ask that you keep this provision in through the omnibus and conference committee process. Secondly, I'm speaking today in support and gratitude for the inclusion of moving the Rare Disease Advisory Committee, this is Article 8, Section 2, away from the University of Minnesota and to be an independent council housed within the Council on Disability. This would allow RDAC to fulfill its legislative purpose, which is to include policy positions and an advisory role to the legislature and other governmental leaders. We've seen the benefits of these shared initiatives that our council and RDAC may share together. And their council has fully endorsed this as well as ours as well. And we look forward to working together and communicating and operating in a collaborative way. And thank you to Representative Ryer for working on this with us. And just in brief, I'd like to thank the committee for including Article 7, Section 6, Unrestricted Access to Healthcare for the Treatment of Rare Diseases. We will continue to collaborate with the Department of Health to resolve a few possible concerns they may have on some language and ensure that it's appropriate for final passage. Thank you to Representative Ryer also for supporting this. And then lastly, we strongly support the Department of Health proposal to support, monitor, and evaluate the effects of long COVID, Article 1, Section 34, a mass disabling event that requires and really justifies the need for further research, monitoring, and surveillance to ensure we protect, care for, and support those experiencing long COVID. I'll keep it brief among the many other provisions. So thank you for your time today. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dively. Appreciate your testimony. We have Julia Burkstaller. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Hi, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Julia Burkstaller, Public Policy Director for the ARC Minnesota. First and foremost, thank you for the work you've done this session, and thank you for this bill. We see many provisions included in your bill, which would be beneficial to people with disabilities, or help address some of the deep challenges that they face, including in Article 1, the expansion of home and community-based services employees scholarship program to include loan forgiveness for direct support professionals as one tool to address the workforce shortage. The statewide monitoring of long COVID incidents and grants that support individuals living with the impact of long COVID. The investments and grants to address health disparities impacting Minnesotans with disabilities. The program to distribute COVID-19 tests, masks, and respirators. And then in Article 2, screening for healthcare coverage or assistance using presumptive eligibility. The many provisions regarding the Ombudsman for mental health and developmental disabilities and assisted living settings. These technical changes build on a strong set of protections in 144G. These protections would also be a great benefit to other residential service settings. And we ask that you consider expanding these protections to other service settings as well. The changes to the definition of palliative care to clarify that it is not synonymous with end-of-life care and not limited to patients with terminal illness. Also, the appropriation to the Palliative Care Advisory Council on Article 10. The prohibition on physical and chemical restraints for purposes of discipline or convenience. The establishment of the Health Equity and Leadership Council, which will provide guidance and advice for the Minnesota Department of Health regarding disparities impacting the health of communities that have been marginalized in our state. People with disabilities experience significant and complex barriers to healthcare services and supports, especially those who are BIPOC and members of the Two-Spirit LGBTQ plus community. And then in Article 3, the addition of metrics on dental utilization for medical assistants and Minnesota care patients, the flexibility of the asset limit for medical assistance as the COVID-19 federal public health emergency expires, the increase to the medical assistance income standard from 100% to 133% of the federal poverty guidelines. This would be a great benefit for people with disabilities in Minnesota. People accessing medical assistance to meet their service and support needs should not have to live in poverty. As a state, we must move towards a society where individuals who access medical assistance can enjoy the benefits of living in the community freed from forced poverty. The continuous eligibility for youth and young adults accessing medical assistance up to age 21. Changes to broaden dental coverage for people accessing medical assistance. The provision which makes seizure detection devices covered under medical assistance. And the dental home pilot project. Access to dental care has been a perpetual problem for people with disabilities who access medical assistance. And this pilot project would address this problem and improve health outcomes for those accessing these services. Very briefly, in Article 4, modernizing language regarding the ombudsperson for managed care, this office acts as an important source of advocacy and information for people with disabilities who access managed care. Article 3, thank you for the provision moving the Minnesota Rare Disease Advisory Council to the Minnesota Council on Disability, as well as the very much appreciated provision to address discrimination and access to transplants based on race or ethnicity, expanding on the legislation passed last session. And lastly, in Article 10, the appropriation for responding to COVID-19 and Minnesota healthcare programs. We are still in the process of analyzing all provisions. As you know, it's a very long bill and we really appreciate your work on this. We look forward to continued collaboration throughout the rest of session to help ensure the proposed policies have a positive impact in the lives of your constituents with disabilities and the disability community statewide. Thank you.
All right, well, thank you very much, Ms. Burkstaller. We really appreciate your testimony today. Okay, next we have, well, Sue Abderholden is here now. So why don't we go to Sue and then we will go to Maren Holden, if that's okay. Ms. Abderholden?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. And I'm sorry, there was a glitch with the email, which this time of year happens all the time. I just want to say that NAMI is very grateful for the policy proposals and funding that's in this bill that will really help address the crisis we're facing in our mental health system. The World Health Organization reported that depression and anxiety have increased 25% worldwide, and we know our children and youth are really struggling. I'll quickly mention the parts of the bill that we strongly support. So in Article 1, we have a huge workforce shortage, and this bill will make it easier for mental health professionals to provide supervision and use the loan forgiveness program, provides a new program to pay for supervision for interns and clinical trainees, targets the mental health professional loan forgiveness program to mental health professionals from culturally specific organizations and rural providers, and creates a scholarship program to help people obtain their master's degree. It also adds money to train more peer specialists and family peer specialists and funding to create a one-stop shop website for people interested in a career in mental health. We support providing a way for people to change their sex assigned at birth on their birth certificate. Being a trans or gender nonconforming person isn't easy, and the suicide rates are high among that community. And so steps that we can take to promote acceptance can help. Thank you for putting in money for 988. It's going to happen on July 1st, whether we like it or not, and we really need money to be able to answer all those calls that come into Minnesota and make sure that people are getting connected to the services in Minnesota, which is why it's important that our call centers be able to answer them. We certainly hope in future years we can actually use a telecom fee, but for right now, we need to make sure we have funds to carry this out. We also support efforts to expand community health workers and to do universal social emotional screening. In Article 2, we support Children's Hospital and adding inpatient psychiatric beds to existing hospitals with emergency rooms. In Article 3, we support the continuous enrollment on Medicaid for children, also the Medicaid for youth who are in foster care up to age 26, expanding access to dental care. We hope that that includes crowns and full access to the smoking cessation tools, along with reducing the burden of cost sharing under Medicaid. On Article 5, we support allowing supervision needed to become a licensed mental health professional to be done through audio and visual communication. This is really going to be helpful for people in rural Minnesota. And there's lots of funding that goes to all sorts of important things. But I will just say that I think it's, again, really important that we focus on workforce retention, that we try to get more people kind of across the line in providing mental health services. I will admit I'm a little confused about which bill is I'm supposed to talk about in terms of the appropriations. But let me just say we're very thankful that there is lots of funding in here for mental health care. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Abderholden. You wouldn't be the only confused person on that score. But pretty soon we'll have the bills together and then we'll all be less confused, I hope. So thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, I think we can go to Maren Halden. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much, Chair Liebling and members. My name is Maren Halden and I'm an attorney at Legal Aid, which includes the Minnesota Good. Disability Law Center. Hey. I have don't have a baby, but I do have my 5-year-old guest with me today. Thank you so much for crafting such a tremendous bill. This bill has so many provisions that will benefit Legal Aid's clients. First and foremost, I really want to thank you for including the provision to increase the Medicaid income standard for people with disabilities to 133% of federal poverty guidelines. This is in Article 3, Section 15. When people with disabilities need Medicaid to meet their support needs, they're subject to an excess income standard, which right now forces people to spend down to 80% of federal poverty guidelines, meaning that any income they get over about $870 each month has to be spent on their healthcare expenses. This has structurally forced people who have disabilities across our state into deep poverty. This will improve on July 1st, but people will still be forced to spend down to eligibility limits lower than other pathways. This provision in Article 3, Section 15 aligns both the spend down and the eligibility threshold, or as we call it, the income standard, with other eligibility pathways, and will mean that more people who are still making quite little money will get to keep more of the income that they've earned while getting the Medicaid supports they need. This will be such a massive improvement for our clients. So thank you so much for including this. There are so many other good provisions in this bill that will help our clients. I'll try to highlight just a few very quickly. Provisions that will help our clients get and keep the health that they need in Article 3. Thank you for including continuous eligibility for Medicaid for children up to 21. That's Section 16. This is such an important way to establish consistency and predictability and coverage. We would love to see this for adults too at some point. Thank you for your attention to the dental coverage in our Medicaid program. That's Article 3, Section 17. And we appreciate the many changes that improve access to Minnesota care, including maintaining the premiums at the American Rescue Plan Act levels. That's Article 3, Section 47. This bill also includes pieces that will really help address inequities in healthcare, including investing in reducing health disparities for people with disabilities in Article 1, Section 44, and expanding the non-discrimination and access to transplant language that was passed last session to include non-discrimination based on race or ethnicity in Article 8, Section 18. Finally, this bill does really several important things to help our state navigate winding down from the public health emergency, including navigator grants in the appropriations, and several pieces in Article 3, extending the COVID-19 asset limit for a period of time, preserving coverage until a person's enrollment, and aligning MAEPD and Minnesota Care premiums with the timing of an enrollee's first enrollment period. Before I close, I just would also switch hats as turn into the MNCCD policy co-chair, the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, and thank you for including two pieces that are critical to our rare disease community. In Article 7, Section 6, improving access to services for diagnosis and treatment of rare diseases, and in Article 8, Section 2, changes to the Rare Disease Advisory Council. And of course, MNCCD also strongly supports moving the income standard to 133%. Thank you so much, Chair Liebling, for putting together such a tremendous bill. We're really grateful for all the work that you've done here. And thanks to the whole committee.
All right. Well, thank you for your testimony, Ms. Halden. Amazing job with a small child on your lap. Very good.
I think you're about to hear soon from actually one of the doctors at Hennepin who'll help bring him into the world. So it's a special guy. Glad to be here.
Okay. Next we have Natasha Chernyavsky. I think I might have said that wrong, but welcome.
No, you're very close. Thank you, Chair Liebling. For the record, my name is Natasha Chernyavsky, and I'm the Legislative and Policy Specialist for Citizens Council for Health Freedom. Our mission is to protect patient and doctor freedom. And although looking over this bill, we can find little to support, we do apply the language in lines 170.11 to 170.19. We greatly appreciate the consideration of any move away from the destructive hospital moratorium. That said, however, we see this bill in its entirety as an expansion of government. The sections that strengthen value-based payments and establish universal healthcare are particularly concerning because they're elements of socialized healthcare system, the antithesis of patient and doctor freedom. That said, I would like to highlight four issues today of particular concern in this bill. First, in Article 1, Section 34, it establishes a statewide monitoring program for those with long COVID. The creation of this tracking system not only infringes on patient privacy, but is especially frustrating because for most, long COVID didn't need to happen. As Dr. Mobeen Syed, MD in California, says, quote, "If the management is done early and aggressively, long COVIDs don't happen," unquote. Article 1, Section 34 is a government research program on patients who are not treated early or aggressively because the government prohibited early treatment. And now this bill proposes to conduct research and collect data on these individuals without their consent. Second, Article 1, Section 38 on universal home visiting of families with or expecting infants, and Article 1, Section 46, the Healthy Beginnings, Healthy Families Act, create voluntary programs for families that include significant data collection. Even though these are listed as voluntary, we are concerned that parents will not understand that this is the government collecting significant data on their families. For both programs, what is the process for receiving parent consent, and is there a Tennyson warning? Third, the language in Article 3, Section 37, line 228.5, that pays the Minnesota Department of Health for conducting newborn screening on infants born at home is concerning. We do not want health officials empowered to harass parents who choose, as allowed by law, not to get newborn screening, or who choose to get private testing to keep their children's DNA from being collected, stored, and used by MDH. Would the Minnesota right to opt out law and a Tennyson warning be given to these parents? Would parents be contacted beforehand, or would a public health official appear uninvited on their doorstep? There are simply not enough protections in this section for parents and their families. Finally, our fourth concern is Article 4, Section 11, which significantly changes the cancer surveillance system. It reduces patient protections and increases access to the patient's medical data. As we have previously said before this committee, we oppose repealing the requirement for physician consent prior to researchers contacting cancer patients and their families. This is especially important because if this language passes, the data of cancer patients and their families will be entered into a nationwide database that will be accessed by government agencies in other states, as well as the federal government and their contractors. All in all, we see significant shortcomings in this bill. There are numerous failures to respect and protect patient privacy, and thus we cannot support HF 4706. Thank you so much for your time, and I'm more than willing to answer any questions.
All right, thank you very much for your testimony. Let's see, next I'm gonna skip the order a little bit and go to Dr. Pace, because I understand he's on call and might need to leave. So Dr. Pace, are you here?
I am here. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Can you hear me?
Yes, please go ahead.
Perfect. My name is Dr. Samantha Pace. Hi, Maren. I work at Hennepin Healthcare in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and I'm currently responsible for covering labor and delivery this afternoon, so I will keep my comments brief. There is so much to appreciate in this bill. I want to echo all of the gratitude for the investments in home visits, community health workers, the long COVID research, investments in residency programs, continuous eligibility for Medicaid for people under 21. It's quite a large bill. I am hopeful and am wanting to comment on multiple articles that you would reconsider funding the creation of the Maternal Health and Substance Use Disorder Task Force in this bill. This language was proposed by Representative Morrison in House File 4146. As a provider of obstetric care, we spent an entire pregnancy building trust and trying to help moms benefit from the full spectrum of prenatal care. This relationship is unfortunately undermined and jeopardized by mandatorily needing to report moms using substances when they are trying to do the right thing for themselves and their families. These are often very complicated family situations, and this can often be further exacerbated by the fear of child welfare involvement. Pregnancy is a time when we know that women are motivated to make substantial change, and we have an opportunity to help the family stay healthy and stay together. We do not currently have statewide uniform guidelines of what to do in the area of maternal health and substance use. There's significant variation across healthcare systems and even between healthcare professionals, and moms cannot have the same expectation and experience at any health system, especially if they need help with substance use. In Minnesota, there is a disproportionate number of American Indian women and babies involved in the child welfare system, and we must address these disparities and ensure these families have what they need to stay together. But without a uniform approach, these disparities will continue, as well as the continued stigma of substance use and pregnancy. We need your help to make progress on this journey and to identify those guidelines that can best serve moms and families statewide. This task force will truly mean more families will be able to get the help they need so they can stay together, allowing us to spend our energy on prevention and treatment of substance use disorder instead of alienating and penalizing families and continuing the stigmatization. Thank you again for the many investments in this bill in our health and our communities, and thank you for allowing me to testify today.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Pace, for being here today. Okay. We will go to, going back again on the list. Next is Toby Pearson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Toby Pearson with Care Providers in Minnesota. Today, on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative, I will begin our testimony and then turn it over to Ms. Huppert to continue. We have testified in committee about providers struggling with staffing, occupancy, and census. In staffing, we testified that we are having severe challenges and that currently there are approximately 23,000 open positions. That's about 20% of our workforce. In last fall, we were losing about 1,500 workers per month. In occupancy, we testified that our staff shortage has contributed to ongoing steep drop in occupancy. Our average occupancy dropped dramatically to around 65%, with 75% of nursing homes currently limiting admissions. In some cases, entire counties do not have available beds. Cash flow, we said we are circling the drain. When we look at the bill before you, we see a mix. I will touch on a couple of the positives and the areas we want to keep working with the author, as well as the departments, and then turn it over to Ms. Huppert. First, thank you for including Article 1, Section 1, the HCBS scholarship, by adding loan forgiveness. Second, Article 1, Section 99, the safety improvement grants. Third, Article 10, Section 2, some PACE implementation money. We've had good conversations and pledged to keep working with the department and the author on Article 2, starting at Section 17, the change in ownership language, and Article 2, starting at Section 27, the assisted living technical changes. Now I will turn it over to Ms. Huppert.
All right, thank you, Mr. Pearson. Erin Huppert, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I am Erin Huppert, Vice President of Advocacy for Leading Age Minnesota, and here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. And I am here to share our opposition to Article 10, Section 10 of the bill, which appropriates funding for a Nursing Home Standards Board. As Mr. Pearson said, we have 23,000 open positions within long-term care in all areas. That's housekeeping, dietary, direct care staff, management. And 40% of our members aren't sure that they can meet cash flow needs beyond 1 month if their primary source of payment, which is the state, is delayed because they have already spent their reserves, they've already used their ARPA or care support, and they have already extended their lines of credit. Perhaps most concerning, 15 nursing homes have closed since 2019, 4 since January of this year. And the reality is that COVID-19 exposed the vulnerabilities of long-term care payment, even with the value-based reform system that was passed in 2015. The current bill has zero funding for nursing homes. Instead, it has a $640,000 appropriation for a 9-person commission to tell us what we already know. Nursing homes need structural investments by the state to enable us to raise wages for our caregivers. That is quite a tongue twister. And it is also with a sense of urgency and the magnitude of our workforce crisis that I share the imperative's caution with Article 10, Section 2,
the workforce incentive grants. While we very much appreciate these grants, one-time incentives will not be enough to secure the promise of senior care for our loved ones when 20% of our workforce is already gone. We urge you to invest in permanent funding solutions for long-term caregiver wages. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hubert. Next, we have Sam Smith. Welcome.
Thank you. I thought it was a little bit later in this hearing, but happy to begin. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sam Smith, and I'm here to testify on the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill on behalf of the Minnesota chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Alzheimer's is a disease of the brain that affects an estimated 1 in 9 Americans age 65 and older at a tremendous cost to families in our healthcare system. Prior to COVID-19, Alzheimer's, another form of dementia, was the fourth leading cause of death in Minnesota and the only leading cause of death with no known treatment or cure. 99,000 Minnesotans live with Alzheimer's or another form of dementia, and we estimate this will reach 120,000 by 2025, an increase of over 21%. The Alzheimer's Association would like to express our appreciation that the House proposal extends funding for the Palliative Care Advisory Council in Article 10. We also value the meaningful investment in community health workers in Article 1. This is an important part of our workforce that bridge the gap between communities and healthcare systems and are especially effective at engaging communities of color. This is a step in the right direction, and we encourage this committee to explore the ways in which community health workers can support people with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. Another positive step is funding for the implementation of PACE programs. This is a proven and innovative model of care for delivering services to frail older adults that require a nursing home level of care to live at home or as independently as possible. However, the Alzheimer's Association would like to express our disappointment that House File 313 from Representative Lee was not included in the bill. This bipartisan legislation would direct the Minnesota Department of Health to develop public health messaging for underserved communities across the state, with culturally specific messages about the importance of early detection diagnosis, awareness of Alzheimer's disease and other dementias, and discussing cognition with a health provider. This legislation is endorsed by the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs and the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. Alzheimer's affects everyone, but the impact is not felt equally. Almost 2/3 of those living with Alzheimer's are women. Most prevalent studies indicate that Black older adults are twice as likely to have Alzheimer's or other dementias as older white adults, with research suggesting Latinos are 1.5 times more likely to have Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia. 1 in 6 Native Americans over the age of 45 are experiencing subjective cognitive decline, a precursor to dementia. It is crucial for the Department of Health to develop culturally appropriate messaging on Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia to ensure that everyone can get an appropriate diagnosis and meaningfully participate in treatment decisions. Thank you for your time and your support. Happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Okay, so although we're not strictly keeping to different articles, we have loosely grouped our testifiers under the article they mainly wanted to address. So next, I think we're going to move to those who expressed an interest in talking mostly about Article 3. Of course, we're not limiting anyone to that one article. But next we have Perla Ramos Rodriguez. Welcome.
Hello, thank you. Thank you for letting me testify and having me on this meeting. Hello, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Perla Ramos Rodriguez. I am an organizer with Unidos Minnesota in Faith and Justice in St. Cloud. We're here where we offer free monthly healthcare clinics for the community. I am here in support of Article 3, Section 43 in the House File 4706 to allow undocumented immigrants under 19 in Minnesota care. Last week, I spoke to your committee in support of the same policy in the governor's budget. I share the story of Reina and her 11-year-old daughter, who are from Honduras and live in Wilmer, Minnesota. Reina's daughter was hospitalized in a coma for a month due to a COVID-19. I thought her father works and pays taxes. Her family does not have access to health coverage. Reina shared, we cannot afford to continue the following appointments needed to restore her being. We are unable to pay the high hospital bills we already have. We are responsible people, but without insurance, we have been devastated. This bill will provide the security to know that when sickness invades your home, you can seek the necessary help. A child of 11 who is just trying to recover from a severe illness and get back to loving a school, that is who this policy will help. We hear many stories like this. Unfortunately, we also hear stories like this one from Christina. Christina has lived in rural Minnesota, Painesville, for 22 years and met and married her husband here. As she told us, he worked long hours, paid taxes, and loved to swim and play sports with their children. Unfortunately, he was undocumented and uninsured. So he received little preventative care and was diagnosed with a stage 4 cancer in September of 2020. Eventually, he qualified for emergency MA, but not on time to treat his disease. He died in 2021, leaving his wife and children behind. I encourage you to also support including undocumented adults in the Minnesota care as a House File 11 and House File 3665 to help families like Christina and many others. Our community support healthcare for all citizens, mixed status, families, and undocumented. We urge to your support this bill for the many good things in it, including allowing undocumented children to qualify for Minnesota care. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Ramos. Appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you.
Robert Hyder. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Robert Hyder, and I'm the policy director at Take Action Minnesota, a multiracial people's organization building power for a government and economy that works for all of us. And thank you for this opportunity to testify today on the omnibus bill. First off, we want to thank you for the inclusion of a Minnesota Care public option located at Article 3, Sections 41 through 46 and 51 through 54. These provisions would make healthcare a reality for nearly all Minnesotans by expanding high-quality, affordable health insurance coverage through Minnesota Care. Unfortunately, not every Minnesotan would have that access to the care they need, as this bill leaves out our undocumented neighbors, essential workers, caretakers, and community members who are over the age of 19. Moving on, we want to thank you for the inclusion of a prescription drug affordability board at Article 6, Sections 29 through 39. A PDAB is a top recommendation made by the Attorney General's bipartisan task force, and it would have the authority to set upper payment limits on high-cost drugs, lowering costs for patients, insurers, and employers at the state. We know that prescription drugs only work if people can afford them, and it's well established that transparency measures alone have no impact on costs without increasing accountability and negotiating power. So this is a crucial provision to bring down those costs. We support the provisions to allow people to opt out of managed care capitated plans and the delivery reform study comparing our current capitated system to alternatives. We also support many provisions to improve people's ability to access coverage and afford care. These provisions include establishing the Healthcare Affordability Board and Patient Protection Office, implementation of the Federal No Surprises Act, maintaining current Minnesota Care premiums, eliminating cost sharing in MA and Minnesota Care, pandemic payments to navigators, and finally, the funding for improving MNsure and DHS IT and enrollment systems, including interactive voice response, increased access for those with limited English, and community-driven improvements. This bill as a whole will benefit Minnesotans, and we urge the committee to support and strengthen it. And thank you for all the work that you put into this bill, and thank you for your time today.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Hyder. Okay, Jeff Nachbar, welcome.
Chair Liebling, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Nachbar, the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance. I'm here today to speak in support of Article 3, Section 15, and will confine my remarks to this increase in the medical assistance income and spend down standard. It's on page 17 of the spreadsheet and on page 192, line 14 of the DE. So thank you so much, Chair Liebling, for taking steps to begin to address the inequity in the MA qualifying standards for low-income elderly and disabled individuals. As you well know, we've been working on this issue for many, many years, and progress has been sparse and painfully slow. We understand that it is slow because addressing this is a heavy lift with significant costs and large fiscal notes. We truly get that and understand that there are many unmet needs that you're addressing. I do like to point out that we should remember that these costs are directly proportional to the amount of money that Minnesota is essentially taking out of people with disabilities' pockets, just so they can get the care they justifiably qualify for. Now, I don't think anybody meant to leave low-income elderly or individuals with disabilities behind in our efforts to improve access to healthcare and community-based services. But the fact remains they are significantly behind, and the steps that you're taking will greatly improve this situation and the quality of life for a great number of Minnesotans. I would be remiss if I failed to mention that this does nothing about the low asset limits we put on people with disabilities. An individual can only hold on to $3,000. And the way that this is structured, we're asking folks with very little income to wait 3 years for this to go into effect. Of course, we're excited about the change coming in the spend down this July, just to get it to 100% of the federal poverty guideline. But please remember, people have had to wait for 4 years for this change to come. We're not ungrateful for these improvements. We just hope that maybe you could find a way to move more quickly or stair step it into place sooner. Finally, I mean, we all know the real issue is going to be if we can get the Senate to agree to take any action on this, and we stand ready to assist in any way we can, and hope and encourage you all to stay strong on this section. Thanks again for your significant efforts to address inequity in the MA qualifying system.
All right, thank you for your testimony, Mr. Nachbar. Okay, Lisa Winkler, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Lisa Winkler, and I'm the Vice President of External Relations for Serve Minnesota, the administrator for AmeriCorps program statewide, and Minnesota's Commission on National and Community Service. This testimony refers to Article 1, Section 45, pages 58 to 10 through 14, funding for the Public Health Corps. Today, I'm here to thank the committee for recognizing the importance of supporting the Department of Health Public Workforce Grant and our Public Health Corps AmeriCorps program in the Governor's Supplemental Budget Bill. This work is more important than ever. Minnesota Public Health Corps will serve a dual purpose. First, to immediately provide carefully trained individuals to help support the overtaxed workforce in our public health system. And second, to create a diverse pipeline of future public health employees. By serving Minnesota's public health agencies, 150 AmeriCorps members will help increase their capacity to engage with their communities in culturally responsive ways, including conducting community health needs assessments and managing projects that advance public health goals. We will do this work in partnership with the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, which will provide expert training and individualized career planning for these AmeriCorps members. All 150 AmeriCorps members who serve each year will receive counseling and support to develop career pathways within the public health system and will receive an AmeriCorps scholarship of $6,400 to further their own education. The grant request of $1 million in each of the next 3 years will increase the AmeriCorps member living allowance to the equivalent of $15 per hour, making service an equitable opportunity for more individuals. The grant will also leverage federal funding of $4.3 million each year. Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for including Minnesota Public Health Corps in the Omnibus Health and Human Services Bill.
All right, thank you very much for your testimony. We now move to loosely designated Article 6, have fires. And the first one on the list is Cami Lavalle. Welcome.
Yes. Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee for the opportunity to provide this testimony today. I wanted to thank you for including the intractable pain bill, which is Article 6, Section 56 of this omnibus bill.
And please state your name and tell us who you're with, if you're with anybody.
My name is Cami Lavalle. I am not with anybody. I am a resident of Minnesota. I am a pain patient, intractable pain patient, palliative care, disabled, and have a few rare diseases that cause the intractable pain. Okay, so that
thank you.
I'm sorry.
Perfect.
About that.
No worries. Go ahead, please.
I am providing testimony specifically on Article 6, Section 56, and I wanted to thank Madam Chair for including the intractable pain bill in this omnibus bill. And I wanted to thank Representative Bierman for championing this bill for years. The reason I am supporting this bill is because it has the unbalanced policies and the gap as far as guidelines not addressing intractable pain has negatively impacted myself and I would say tens of thousands of Minnesotans. And so the language in this bill will help not only the providers treat their patients, but will help patients like me to receive continued care so we can have a better quality of life, increased function, and work on our goals so we could get back to work if we are within the population that is an option. The guidelines and the policies in Minnesota lacked any mention of intractable pain. So that is why this legislation is so vital. This will fill a huge gap in what is happening right now. And it will stop patients like me and worse off than me, including cancer patients, from falling through the cracks. And at the same time, it has safeguards and guardrails in there to make sure that the physicians are monitoring their patients to make sure they don't have any problems with misuse or diversion. And so I'm just very grateful that this bill was included in the omnibus bill. It is vital. I cannot say enough thank yous that will suffice for this. So thank you very much for the time and believing in this legislation and including it. Thank you and have a great afternoon.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Lavalle. We really appreciate that you're here to speak with us today.
Thank you.
Okay, Tina Sands, welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. I'm trying to figure out how to turn my camera on, but apparently I can't. My name is Tina Sands, and I am speaking in my personal and not professional capacity. And I also speak towards the needs of people with intractable pain throughout Minnesota who have also experienced these issues. There we go. Oh, I thought I had my camera on. I'm sorry. It is my sincere hope that HF 4706, Article 6, Section 56 will serve to address the real and perceived understandings of our medical guidance as it relates to people with intractable pain who are in need of both short and long-term opioid therapies. As a woman before me spoke, you know, there are guardrails in the current legislation, and there are items to protect other people who may not be in intractable pain. Intractable pain is something that is way beyond the scope of what a lot of people ever experience. I am a person who lives in constant pain due to several medical conditions, including Sherman's disease and colitis. And over many years before ever trying opioid medication, I had exhausted every medical therapy. I did physical therapy for years, surgery, yoga, acupuncture, muscle relaxants, and so on. And it was only in 2011, when I reached the point of being unable to work or even walk due to pain, that I consented to try carefully managed opioid therapy. I am able to remain working and have a fairly good quality of life due to carefully monitored medication. And in 2016, when the CDC guidelines came around, it created sudden changes in policies and necessitated lots of changes in the way doctors prescribe. I am not a candidate for surgery due to my personal condition. And so the best I can do is this. I know my time is running short. I would just say pain is expensive for intractable pain patients because of the rules created by the OPWG. I am required to see a pain specialist every single month, even though I qualify for palliative care, and submit random drug tests at a cost of several hundred dollars to monitor my medications, even though in 54 years, I have never abused or become addicted to medications. I would add that these are issues that I've experienced as a white woman of the dominant culture. I've also heard stories from friends of other cultures who have experienced these issues to a worse degree. I'll close with, our disabled people need your help. There are people with very serious conditions who need medication prescribed by physicians. This is no longer a matter of just patients and disabled people's rights, but of human rights. And I am sympathetic and agree to treatment options for addiction. These aren't people with addiction. We are people who need these medications. And I am available to answer if any questions. I thank you so much for your consideration as a committee. This is very important to so many people who have disabilities. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Sands. Next, we'll go to Nicole Bettinger. Nicole Bettinger, I understand she might not be here. Okay, I don't think she is. So next would be Todd Hess. Dr. Hess, welcome.
Yes, hello. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Madam Chair Liebling. I appreciate the time again to talk about the Intractable Pain Amendment, which I really want to thank you, as we met in the community before, for your understanding, for your thoughts on the bill and your help. I am Dr. Todd Hess. I've been a pain specialist now for over 30 years. I'm board certified in anesthesiology and pain medicine, and I've had my entire practice here in the state of Minnesota now 31 years. So again, thanks to all of you. Thanks to Representative Bierman for his help with the intractable pain, Representative Baker and the others on the committee who had also spoken in favor of this bill. This bill, Chair Liebling, is really to help right the wrongs of the CDC guidelines. As we know, as pain specialists since 2012, we were very concerned that pain patients would be left out in this. And we were concerned about the MME and the hard numbers that were put down. We know pain is difficult to treat, and there is no one size fits all. And we certainly knew there was an opioid crisis. We've shut down pill mills. We do better prescribing. Education is better. And certainly also awareness of chemical dependency. So much good has been done. The unfortunate, though, is patients with intractable pain. This has had a chilling effect on prescribing. And you'll hear this, I'm sure, often, that it has really made physicians really terrified. I really appreciate Dr. Rice and his comments earlier, and rural medicine even, concerned of access. The CDC guidelines were not even meant for pain specialists, and we've had targets on our back. But rurally, where family medicine does basically everything, they do a wonderful job with pain patients, and they have really been shut out. And really, the work they could do would be so great if we had this bill to support to get rid of these MME levels and the decredentialing that we're threatened with, the medical board reviews that we're threatened with, and literally, seriously, the targets on our back. I'm sure this was an unintended part of the CDC, at least I hope it was, but we need to change that. And I believe as Minnesotans, we always are progressive. We always do what's right. We put patients first. So by putting patients first, we know opioids do work. There has been some misinformation sent out there, but opioids can work long-term and without all these dose creepages. I also want to let you know that this bill is not a pro-opioid bill. This is a pro-patient bill. What it does is it gives us the right to treat our patients as we need to. It takes the issue of this MME number and these various things that Dr. Rice had already said about with withholding of the meds and changing the insurance and those things. I also want you to know, those of you who supported this, that actually you are in good company. The support has come down strong for this. You know, the AMA has supported legislation like this. Thank Dr. Rice and the MMA. They were wonderful partners, and Randy, to try to help us with this. The American Society of Anesthesiologists, of which I'm a part of, the American Cancer Society, and many others. So you have good support. You have good education behind you. There's good data for what we did here. I've also had lawyers review the bill, and they said it is well-written, it is concise, and it is good. So hands off and hats off to all of you. Let us do this to right the wrongs. Let's be the progressive ones in the nation to always put patients first. And if you need my help in any way, I am always at your disposal. To all of you on the committee and to you, Chair Liebling, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hess, for your testimony today. Absolutely. Okay, we now have folks who are testifying on things that are not in the bill. So the first on the list is Jean O'Connell. Welcome.
Again, I'm trying to start my video, but hopefully you can hear me. There we go. Chair Liebling, thank you so much for including my testimony today. My name is Jean O'Connell. I'm a board member of the Hemophilia Foundation of Minnesota Dakotas. I'm also the sister of four siblings who have hemophilia. We were disappointed that our provision embodying House File 3611, authored by Representative Morin, was not included in the omnibus bill. We had a robust hearing in this committee and Congress, and we respectfully submit that this provision is something that could alleviate high drug costs for fragile populations in Minnesota. Hemophilia is a rare genetic bleeding disorder that impairs the ability of blood to clot properly. And without treatment, people with hemophilia bleed internally, leading to severe joint damage, permanent disability, or even death. Patients depend on prescription drugs to treat or avoid painful bleeding episodes, and that treatment is very expensive, costing anywhere from $250,000 to $1 million annually. And it's really important to understand that these drugs are not available in any generic form. Copay assistance helps patients afford out-of-pocket costs for their medications. The insurance companies are gladly accepting those payments and then telling Minnesotans that they don't count toward their out-of-pocket maximums. My father, Bernard McGuire, was an insurance agent in Minnesota for over 25 years. He would be appalled to know that this practice is being allowed in Minnesota. I'd like to share a friend's story. She has twin boys with hemophilia. She works for a large Minnesota corporation with good healthcare benefits and was caught off guard last year when her health plan informed her mid-year that the copay assistance for her son's medications no longer counted toward her out-of-pocket maximums and that she owed $10,800 before she could pick up her next prescription. Her son's medications cost $3,000 per month per child. And again, there are no generic drugs available for hemophilia. I would urge you to please include HF 3611 in the omnibus bill and put an end to copay accumulators in Minnesota. Our rare disease communities need your help now. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Jamie Sexton.
Thank you, Madam Chair and esteemed members of the Health, Finance, and Public Policy Committee for allowing me to address you today. My name is Jamie Sexton. I'm the Director of State Policy for the Immune Deficiency Foundation, where I have the privilege of representing the estimated 4,300 Minnesota residents who are diagnosed with a primary immunodeficiency. I'm here today to share our disappointment that the accumulator adjustment program language within Representative Morin's House File 3611 was not included in the omnibus bill. We would love to continue to work with you all and the entire legislature to get this language incorporated to ensure that all copays count in Minnesota, which would significantly benefit patients in the state. The language we're discussing today from House File 3611 is simple. It ensures that all payments made by or on behalf of patients are counted toward their out-of-pocket maximum or any cost-sharing requirement. Simply put, we're seeking to codify the status quo as copay assistance, regardless of the source, has traditionally always applied towards patients' cost-sharing requirements and out-of-pocket maximums. That, of course, was before the rise in the use of copay accumulator adjustment programs, which are harming patients by excluding copay assistance payments from out-of-pocket cost-sharing calculations, contrary to how those have traditionally been applied. That exclusion of copay assistance is often results in patients no longer being able to access their life-saving medications. To date, 13 states and Puerto Rico have enacted protections against this unfair practice. More than 30 states have introduced similar bills, and a federal bill has been introduced to address this practice in ERISA plans. You may also be aware that the National Council of Insurance Legislators, or NCOIL, has also endorsed model legislation around this issue, further highlighting the timeliness of addressing this practice and ensuring that all copays count for patients. For this reason, I respectfully request the original House File 3611, which was laid over for possible inclusion, be incorporated into the omnibus bill. Thank you for your time, and I hope to serve as a resource to you as you consider this request.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have James Paste. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I am James Paste, Executive Director of the Hemophilia Foundation of Minnesota and Dakotas. I want to first thank you for all the good work you're doing toward the health of Minnesotans. We hope that the committee will consider placing House File 3611 for inclusion into the omnibus bill. It's had an informational hearing in this committee, and it passed through the House Commerce Committee. The bill has bipartisan support in both the House and Senate, and a coalition of patient organizations of over 30 in support of the bill. Many rare diseases like hemophilia are very expensive to treat. And as a result, there are affected Minnesota families and individuals who rely on third-party assistance to help their out-of-pocket costs, which often hit the max every year, which of course is over $17,000 for a family. Now, some health plans have taken aggressive steps to deny families from getting this assistance intended to help them. Families are shocked to find out that they still owe money after the money's already been collected, but not applied to their out-of-pocket costs. This practice known as the accumulator, it's wrong, it's harmful to families, and it should be banned in Minnesota. We know the cost of health insurance premiums and out-of-pocket costs are at an all-time high. The idea that insurance companies have a right to deny third-party payments to help families is confounding and troubling. Once a required out-of-pocket bill is paid in full, insurance companies should not have the right to deny any payment or to demand that the payment come directly from a family's wallet. Not every family has $17,000 to pay. Please support the inclusion of 3611 in as an amendment to end copay accumulators in Minnesota. Our rare disease communities need your help now, and there's a coalition of 30 patient groups asking for your help. We ask for your help, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you.
All right, thank you for your testimony. And lastly, we have Sarah Durr. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Sarah Durr. I'm the Executive Director here at the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. I'm also testifying today on behalf of all of Minnesota Pharmacy and the Minnesota Pharmacy Alliance. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on behalf of these groups today. Minnesota pharmacies are critical healthcare access points for patients. Most patients live within 5 miles of their pharmacy and see their pharmacist on average 18 times per year, which is more frequent than patients see any other healthcare provider. Today, I would like to make a couple brief remarks regarding Article 5 and Article 6 in the author's amendment to HF 4706. We greatly appreciate the inclusion of pharmacy in the House Health Omnibus legislation. First, Article 5, Section 18 of the bill includes Representative Morrison's legislation that allows pharmacists to work with physicians and other providers to administer prescribed medications through subcutaneous and/or intramuscular injections to patients. This is something pharmacists are doing every day with immunizations and mental health and substance use disorder medications. We appreciate the committee including this important evolution in the practice of pharmacy in Minnesota. We are also extremely appreciative of the committee including Representative Holland's legislation authorizing pharmacists to prescribe medications that prevent a Minnesotan from contracting HIV in Article 6, Section 54 of the bill. With over 9,000 Minnesotans living with HIV and AIDS and more than 200 new cases each year, this provision will save lives and reduce the spread of this preventable disease. Another provision that we applaud the committee for including in Article 6, Section 45 is Representative Freiberg's legislation that will include insurance companies from implementing payer-mandated white bagging, a policy that risks medication safety and removes patients and provider choice. This practice disrupts care to patients who need access to medications for diseases such as multiple sclerosis or needs for chemotherapy or other important medications. This will allow for timely access to life-saving medications for patients. In addition to these provisions, we are working to understand how the new drug price transparency program language and how this will be operationalized. The reporting requirement is in Article 6, Sections 6 through 21, could have an impact to pharmacies with reporting. In general, we are supportive of transparent drug pricing and healthcare costs. One provision that is not in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill is that is included in the Senate House Omnibus Bill is Representative Bonner and Senator Duckworth's Amendment HF4009. The amended language would authorize pharmacy technicians with oversight from pharmacists to provide immunizations. This is extremely important as pharmacies have utilized the federal authorities throughout the pandemic, and removing this ability when federal authorities expire would be a step backwards and have a large impact on patient care and pharmacist workforce issues. Currently, pharmacists and pharmacy technicians have administered over 3.5 million COVID-19 vaccines in our state alone. Every MPHA member that I have discussed this with has stated that they could not continue the level of care that pharmacists are currently providing if technicians are no longer able to immunize. I urge you to consider this important provision, which has been agreed upon by stakeholders, including the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy, the APRNs and NMPs, and the Medical Association, as well as manufacturers and patient groups. Thank you for the time and allowing me to testify today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you, Dr. Durr. Okay, members, if there are any clarifying questions that you wish to ask any of the testifiers, we could take those now. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions. So with that, members, I think we are going to conclude our hearing for today. So I think what I need to do is lay over our bill, which is House File 4706, and we will take it up again tomorrow. And tomorrow we will have member discussion and we will have markup of the bill. And then our expectation is that we'll be moving the bill out to Ways and Means. So with that, members, and so tomorrow we are meeting at 1 o'clock. It could be a long meeting. We're scheduled until 5:30. And of course we have a very long bill. I appreciate the testimony that we've heard today. And I will look forward to seeing all of you, or at least the members. I'll look forward to seeing you tomorrow and when we do our markup. So with that, members, we stand adjourned.